Hello again, and welcome to Vox Pop, WAMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Joe Donahue. Robin Williams had publicly admitted on several occasions that he struggled with manic depression for many years of his life, but that admission was largely eclipsed by his genius on stage and screen. For a man who lifted the spirits of so many, he succumbed to a battle with the severe depression of his own. As of 2011, suicide was the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. According to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and depression is the most common affliction many suicide victims suffer from prior to their deaths, according to studies. It's an issue that is riddled with stigma. It is often difficult for many to talk about. We will talk about it this afternoon, and we welcome your comments as well. Dr. M. Dolores Cimini is a New York State licensed psychologist and assistant director for prevention and program evaluation at the University at Albany. Dolores, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Dr. Robin Tassinari is professor of psychiatry and internal medicine at Albany Medical Center. He's a board-certified psychiatrist with over 40 years of experience in the field. Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for asking.
To be part of today's discussion, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551. The number again, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. You can also get in touch with us online, and you can see all the ways to do that by going to wamc.org/voxpop, wamc.org/voxpop. Dr. Tassinari, what do you think it is about a celebrity, certainly of the magnitude of Robin Williams, that kind of wakes us up to this? I think most of us at some point in our lives know someone who has committed suicide or has attempted suicide. Certainly many have, if not most. What is it about a high-profile case like this you think that still shocks us?
Well, I think in this particular case it shocks us because, unlike people you may know, we don't see everything about Robin Williams. We see only the very positive, wonderful, creative, and bright-spirited gentleman. So it's a huge shock because that implies, even though he made comments about his addiction and his depression, we only see the positive side. So when this happens, it's hardly credible. It seems so out of character. And yet, you know, he was suffering with all kinds of stuff in his private life that we are certainly not aware of. I think that's why it's such a big shock. And also the people that we see as celebrities, we put them on a different level to some extent. We expect in some sense more from them at times. And when it happens, we can't believe that it happened.
Dr. Cimini, what do you think brings us to still grapple with this?
Well, the challenges in society and the stresses that we all face are getting more and more complex. We see poverty, we see war, we see all kinds of stresses going on, family issues, financial issues, and those can be very, very difficult for us to deal with sometimes. And as a result of that, we may feel depressed. We may be experiencing different kinds of reactions. And for some, there may be thoughts of suicide as part of the thinking.
I do want to mention, in a bit of a disclaimer at the beginning of the program, we certainly welcome your phone calls at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1. But with the two doctors this morning, if you are someone who is dealing with very real issues and does not want to talk about the issue but talk about your concerns and your problems with suicide, we urge you to call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And that phone number is 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-8255, or also suicidepreventionlifeline.org, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. And I think when you look at this, Robin, as far as an overall issue, and we look at the numbers, as I mentioned in the introduction, of course, there is still a stigma attached. And I wonder, will that, in your opinion, always be there, or will we reach a point where that has been erased somewhat?
We've been fighting stigmatization of mental illnesses for years, and to some extent we've come a long way. You know, celebrities who get out and talk about being depressed, and, you know, there's a bunch that have. That's helped a lot, but stigma's still there, certainly. And with suicide, there's a big stigma as well, which is unfortunate because it causes a certain degree of avoidance when people who have concerns don't actually ask the person who they're worried about because they're afraid that that stigma will be upsetting. And yet, the one thing that these people may need right away is for someone to say, are you okay? Are you safe? Are you? And the responses are quite dramatic. And then they are more open about discussing it. Dismissing it or ignoring it is a huge mistake. So the biggest problem with stigma is that we don't help our relatives, friends, family members when we know they're down because we don't even bring it up as a possibility. Some people have this misperception that if you ask somebody if they've had suicidal thoughts, they're going to say, oh, that's a great idea, I hadn't thought of that. But indeed, depressed people all think of it. They think of it. That doesn't mean they're suicidal. But asking is an important part of destigmatization.
Doris, you work at the University yes. of Albany. As I mentioned, you work a lot with students. Are there special circumstances there?
Yes, as a matter of fact, if we look at statistics on suicide and risk for suicide, college students aged 17 to 25 within the lifespan are at highest risk for suicide. And so we really have to work extra hard in this very difficult period to address things like stigma, to respond with prevention, to really address the entire campus community. And the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration of the federal government has really been very, very supportive in giving funding for colleges and universities. And we've been the recipient of one of those grants to build programs to increase students' ability and opportunity to get help. We've done media campaigns to reduce stigma. We talked about the high percentage of students that would refer a friend who's thinking about suicide to help. We try and increase access to our counseling center. We actually place some of our psychologists right on campus in the middle of highly trafficked areas that students go by so they don't have to feel stigmatized and come to our center. We're right there with them. And so that's been very successful for us.
We welcome your phone calls this afternoon on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. I was struck when you were talking, Dr. Tassinari, about listening and listening to people and hearing what they have to say when there are times, and even if they're depressed, it doesn't mean necessarily that they're suicidal. I was struck by a tweet by another celebrity, Jimmy Kimmel, and I mentioned this on the air this morning, that he tweeted that Robin Williams was as sweet a man as he was funny. If you're sad, please tell someone. And is that good advice? I mean, should there be that open line of a feeling that if you're sad, you should let somebody know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think everyone would be surprised the degree of compassion and concern that people have if you say so. You know, the sad part is I noticed there's been a lot of negativity today about, believe it or not, about this suicide and blame and anger, which, you know, you can sort of understand, but you don't realize the pain people are going through.
In one way, just clarify that for a moment, because I haven't personally come across that. So what exactly do you mean?
There were a couple of folks that talked about how this was selfish and people are angry at him. I know it's minimal, but this brings up a group of folks who don't understand that depression is an illness, that depressed people are in pain, that suicide is not logical. In other words, you know, somebody might say, well, if he looked at the pros and cons, he would have sat down and say, well, I'm going to live. Well, that's not how it works.
Right.
We see every week, in my work at Albany Med, at least four or five people who've tried to commit suicide and unfortunately have failed. And these folks are not necessarily illogical. They didn't plan it. They later, having survived, are happy that they did survive. But at that moment, we're talking about a degree of profound sadness and hopelessness. So, you know, I think we people who are sad should talk about it. It's very important. That also helps to eliminate the stigma so that when somebody says it, nobody goes, oh, I don't want to hear that. I mean, that's not the way it works. We're right. All of us are open. You don't have to be a psychiatrist to be compassionate and open to someone who's sad.
So bring us to that moment. What brings a person to that moment where they think that the only answer is to end the life that they have been living?
I don't think any of us who haven't been there would ever know that, but I know that people who are depressed, the thought of suicide is there. And some people see it as, it's sort of like a smoker who hasn't smoked in 20 years but keeps a pack of cigarettes in their pocket, which they could never smoke at this point. But people who are depressed will say it's always an option. And it's always there. And then they go, oh, good, I feel better. Because I can always, if things get really bad, I can kill myself. Why it happens and happened in this case, we don't know. I know he had a certain degree of risk factors. We're not beginning to even presume to understand what he was going through. But it must have been a sense that there was no way. I know he just got out of rehab. Maybe he was frustrated by that. There was talk about him thinking of downsizing his life. He is in an age group close to it where suicide not only is more common, but the people who do try to commit suicide usually succeed. People 65 and over, there's usually very little escape planned. So it's more of a decision that's made at that moment, and they decide to do it. There's no going back. And I just got the tweet just now that it was hanging. So people that do that typically are not, you know, taking some pills and calling the emergency room for help or calling a friend. He meant to do it.
It's serious.
And so at that moment, for whatever reason, his hopelessness was that bad. Despite all the friends and the huge support and his finances and his children and all the support he had, he felt that there was no other way. And so that's why we need to always reach out to people who we feel are sad.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will start to go to the many phone calls that we have on Vox Pop this afternoon. We're talking about suicide and suicide prevention as well as depression. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also join us online at wamc.org/voxpop. We'll return to the conversation after this short break.
Support comes from SPAC, the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center at SPAC on August 17th, featuring the Miro Quartet performing Monumental Beethoven, and August 19th, CMS musicians join the Miro Quartet to perform extraordinary quintets, SPAC.org. Taft Farm, Great Barrington, now harvesting pesticide-free vegetables from their 200-acre IPM farm, sweet corn, berries, and 75 varieties of heirloom tomatoes. Open daily, taftfarms.com. Alarms of Berkshire County, offering full-service residential and commercial security and life safety monitored systems based on individual or corporate needs for nearly 35 years. AlarmsofBerkshireCounty.com. And Great Barrington Rudolph Steiner School, Waldorf education in the Berkshires, fall openings for kindergarten and first grade, open house Saturday, August 16th, gbrss.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Vox Pop. This afternoon we're discussing the issue of suicide, suicide prevention, and depression. Joining us this afternoon, Dr. M. Dolores Cimini, a New York State licensed psychologist and assistant director for prevention and program evaluation at the University at Albany. Dr. Robin Tassoneri joins us as well, professor of psychiatry and internal medicine at Albany Medical Center. He's a board-certified psychiatrist with over 40 years of experience in the field. We welcome your calls this afternoon, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. Before we go to the phone calls, Dr. Tassoneri, I was also struck by something that you said a moment ago about how when we look at this, that there was some negativity. And the one thing that I did hear that I thought was interesting was some people questioning the treatment that he had been receiving, that he had been in rehab, that he had been seeking counseling. So at what point does that break down, where you are just as recent as July, he was seeing to these issues of where that starts to break down? I'm not looking at his particular case, but in general, is that a common thing that can happen?
Well, you know, I would hope not. I would hope people in counseling would be in a better situation than people that are not. But given, you know, the experience of psychiatrists and psychologists over the years, I have to say that we as well are many times surprised when there is a breakdown like this and it ends tragically. And we can look back and we can try to figure out what and why. And I'll be honest with you, we're baffled at times as well, because no one really knows what's happening inside someone's mind at times, even the therapist. And so, you know, I have to say, this field doesn't have many lab tests for what's going on. We do rely on our patients to tell us, but patients who and individuals who are determined to do this sometimes will do it without any warning. And I suspect he was getting wonderful treatment, I suspect. And I'm sure his therapist is as surprised as we are.
Dr. Smini, you would agree with that?
Yes, I would definitely agree. Sometimes we really just can't know what leads a person to take their lives. But the important thing is that we want to stress that treatment works and it is effective. And I would encourage anyone who is feeling depressed, anyone listening in the audience, and anyone who may be thinking about suicide to please reach out to friends, to family, to people they know, to doctors, and call the Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK.
1-800-273-TALK is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You can also reach them online, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. We have many people on our lines, and we'll get to as many as we possibly can. And we begin with Jean, who is in Middletown. Jean, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for being a part of our conversation.
Thank you.
So what is your question?
Okay. Actually, it's more of a statement.
Okay.
I'm 59 years old, and I have been dealing with depression and suicidal ideation and suicide attempts since my first hospitalization at 12 years old. People around me who look at me and think they know me say, you're successful, you're a genius, you've done this, you've done that. They don't understand that's all rational. When I'm in clinical depression, I don't see it, I don't feel it, I can't see it, I can't believe it. And no one, I agree with, I'm so glad with the professionals that you have, because they are so much right on target. And they are right also. I've been a clinician. I've been on both sides of the couch. A clinician only knows what the patient tells them. Mm-hmm. And if you are serious, if you're at a point, especially when you're up in our age, Robin Williams and myself, I'm going to lump us together. We've been through the doors enough times to know what not to tell you. Because we know if we tell you the wrong thing, our butts are going to be back in the hospital.
So, Jean, if you don't mind me asking a personal question, do you feel that in your experience that is no longer an option for you, or do you see in the future that it could still possibly be an option?
I absolutely believe that it could still be possible, and this is why. The last time I attempted suicide, there was no reason. When I woke up in the hospital, and of course the first, you know, questions the non-medical professionals ask you is, you know, what happened? Why did you do this? I had no reason. It was like a light switch flipped, and the plan was boom, right there in my mind, and it was like I was a robot or an automatic pilot watching myself do what I was doing and fully intended to die. And it was only because that I'm married and I have a husband that notices when I'm not in bed
so
I'm alive.
So is this a case where, Doctor Tessinari, I'll throw this to you for a moment. And Gene, thank you very much for calling, and best of luck to you. I thank you very much for sharing your experience. And obviously, without diagnosing Gene specifically, is that true that there is no reason, or she just hasn't, or someone like her hasn't detected it yet?
Well, it's of course, like you said, it's hard for me to know. I'm hoping that if indeed she has depression, that she's getting treatment. Sometimes, as she said, I'm not even aware that I'm depressed, and that brings an interesting point up with regards to depression in people over 60. What is such an amazement to most of us is that when you hear the word depression, you think sadness. Everybody does. You may even say, Jay, I feel depressed today. But with depression, there's more criteria than sadness. And in the geriatric population, sadness may not even be a factor. There's a lot of other criteria that go into depression, and we forget that. So loss of interest is the next big one. We have to look for that. And others, you know, physical signs, sleep problems, appetite problems. But some patients over 60 do not know they're depressed, and so they don't go for help. Or if they go to their family practitioner, they don't look sad. The doctor says, are you depressed? No, I'm fine. And then they look for medical reasons for why they're not eating or sleeping. So that's an important thing. And so, again, her comment makes me, I think, just it clarifies what may have happened with Robin Williams, and that is, you know, it happens so quickly, because you had asked before, what happens at that last moment? We don't know. We just don't know.
Yeah. And I think what Gene says also speaks as much to the responses of the people around her as the response that she had herself to her own feelings, that many times what we don't do is we're not direct with people who we might suspect might be thinking about suicide. We don't ask about it because we may be afraid to ask about it. We don't really listen as much as we could about where the person is really at and what they're thinking about. The tendency is to argue and say, why are you thinking of that? Or I dare you to go ahead and take your life. And really, those things are not helpful. It's important for us, if we know somebody is very depressed or thinking about suicide, to ask the question directly, to listen, to not argue, to present the fact that there is hope, but not be glib about it, and to offer assistance in helping the person seek resources for help.
How does depression often manifest itself? I mean, several years ago, I was on a trip with my wife in Florida, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I was just paralyzed with fear, and I had this I was like in the fetal position, rocking back and forth, and I couldn't move, and I realized, you know, that something was wrong, and through treatment, I found out that obviously I was suffering from depression. At what point do you think most people come to that realization? Because for me, it was, yes, my wife was there, but I had called my mom, who said, well, yes, I have that as well. So there's a genetic component in here too.
Absolutely. And I think, like you said, some people who first experience it don't know what it is. It hits you like a rock. Like, why do I feel that?
I didn't. Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why do I feel sad or not interested in what's going on, and why am I feeling distant? And yes, there's a strong genetic component to depression, and we have to know that. And we have to. That's why it's important to talk about it, because if we don't talk about it, children, relatives won't know that that's a genetic compound. And, and yet, by the same token, this is not an old, totally hopeless discussion here. This treatment for depression. Depression is a very treatable disorder.
Very preventable.
I think it's important for everyone to know that despite what happened, you know, yesterday with Mr. Williams, depression is treatable, and it should be treated vigorously, quickly, and with all the support from friends, doctors, families that we can possibly muster, because it is a treatable condition, not unlike any other medical condition.
Yeah, and as Dr. Tessinari says, there are a number of signs beyond sadness that may indicate depression. For example, a person may sleep more than usual or less than usual. They may have changes in appetite. They may feel hopeless. They may feel that life is a burden. They may have trouble concentrating or lose interest in things that they love to do, like watching football or playing sports or whatever. So there are a number of things that could signal depression, and it's really important to notice when there is a change, when something doesn't feel right, and when we, especially around when we experience a loss like a death or an illness, depression is more likely to occur during those times.
Let's go back to the phones and go to Valerie in Saratoga. Valerie, good afternoon. Thank you for being part of our discussion.
Hi. I agree with everything everybody said. I was always a morose child, but I never knew it was depression. And Dr. Robin Tessinari helped diagnose me many years ago. He probably forgets. Mindser. I was trying to come up with a question for you so you could help some other people. And aside from getting out of yourself as a person who suffers from depression and am, thank God, medicated now,
right.
I still have a suicide plan in the back of my mind that won't harm anybody but me. But besides from getting out of yourself, what can a depressed person do deal with it?
And before he answers that, I want you to clarify what you mean by get out of yourself.
Do things for other people. It helps you not to think about yourself.
All right. Should you
even Betty White said get a pet. Because
right.
It makes you get up in the morning.
Although at some degree, shouldn't you be thinking about yourself, Dr. Tessinari?
You should be thinking of yourself. And I want Dolores to come in here, too, because she does deal with prevention and probably is very versed in this. But it's true with depressed patients that I treat. What I say to them is, as the caller mentions, you know, get out, do things. And people will say, I don't want to get out. And you know what I'll tell them? I'll say, even if you don't enjoy it, I want you to go out. I want you to visit your friends. I want you to go to dinner. I want you to do the things you used to like to do, even if you don't want to do them. And
right.
What's remarkable is once they do them, it really does help because there's more to treating depression than medications. And that's one thing. And I give her credit for making that attempt. And I'm hoping you keep doing it because that's important. Get out, do things. Do things you used to like to do, even though you don't think you want to. And it's remarkable, the response.
And the term that was given to me in therapy was fight through it.
Of course.
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course. And I think the thing about major depression that's so amazing is that when you're in a depression, the worst symptoms, not sadness or sleep, the worst symptom is hopelessness. And I've taken care of patients who have had recurrent depressions, and when they get better, you know, they'll have a recurrence and they'll come in and say, I can't do this anymore. I think I might be suicidal. And I say, don't you remember what happened before? And that hope, I'll say, don't you realize that hopelessness, once it went away, you did fine. We have to fight, like your doctor told you,
yes.
to fight on, because the hopelessness is the worst symptom of depression.
Right.
Takes away all your
yeah.
future.
Dr. Smith.
For the college students that we work with, we actually have a number of programs to help them fight that hopelessness and get out of themselves. Colleges and universities encourage students many times to do things like go out and exercise, to keep their routines. There's one college in California that actually has a program for students who are depressed where they pair them up with a peer, and the peer and the student who's depressed go out and walk and exercise every day. So not only is activity going on, but also there's a source of support there. And another thing that's been very helpful for our college students, and really people of any age, is to look at where your supports are. Even though you may not have energy at that moment to pursue those supports, know what they are. List them. List their phone numbers and their email addresses. Try and reach out to them and let them know how you're feeling so that they could be helpful to you.
Let's go to one more call before we take another break. We'll go to Mark in Washington County. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm going to come at this from a little different direction as far as depression.
Okay.
I'm 62, and when I was in my 20s and 30s, I did seem to have periods of depression. But at the end of that, depression was always something that happened that was like an aha moment where something good came from it. I discovered something that I didn't expect, or an idea came into my head that was useful for advancing my career or whatever. But the point being is that I got to the point where when I felt depressed, I was looking for that aha at the end, and it usually did come. What happened in 1984, I ruptured a disc in my back, and it was very painful, and I have back problems most of my adult life. And so I was seeing I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and one of the things that was prescribed was an antidepressant. And the doctor that I was seeing for many years has since retired. And he was at Sunnyview, and he was a very good rheumatologist. And he put me on for Zoloft, and I had trouble with that. And then he put me on Effexor, and I take a very small dose of it every day. And the question I have is that was a kind of an off-label use. I said to the doctor, "I'm not depressed," and he said, "No, but your body is because of all the pain that you're suffering." And so he gave me this drug, and I had an experience a few years ago where I was in France and I ran out of medication, and by the time I got on the plane, I was a basket case. I mean, I was weeping at the movie and then laughing, and as soon as I got home, I took one of the pills, and I felt better. I'm not sure that some of these antidepressants are necessarily the best answer for some of these problems. As I said, I'm taking a minimal dose of it, and I understand that Effexor is not particularly doesn't have a lot of side effects, except that if you try to stop taking it, you know, you become depressed.
Especially over a great period of
20 years
of time, right?
Yeah, 20 years almost, and now I'm hooked on this stuff.
And okay, I'm just going to stop you there because I want Dr. Tassinari to answer this question. As far as being hooked on what's necessary, and at times when that type of medication is necessary, especially when it's being given for something that isn't labeled as depression.
Well, with fibromyalgia, if your body is in pain, I was told that, you know, that you're even though you may not fully appreciate it, that you are depressed because you're fighting off the pain. And it took me a while to come to grips with that.
We just have a lot of people on the line, and I want to give Dr. Tassinari a chance to
answer
the question. Go ahead.
Well, I knew your rheumatologist, a wonderful man who did treat fibromyalgia a lot. He was probably the best man in the area to treat it.
Great doctor.
He's a wonderful man, great friend of mine. And he also believed, it's true, that with chronic pain, especially when there's no obvious cause and this, very uncomfortable, that depression was there, and he treated it regularly with antidepressants. I think there's a difference between stopping an antidepressant and feeling horrible and stopping it over time. Some people who stop their antidepressant suddenly can get some kind of a reaction. It doesn't mean you're hooked, because there is no addiction, but if you stop an antidepressant rather quickly, rather than tapering, you know, you might find some side effects that can remind you of depression. I'm not saying you should stop it at all. If
no,
it's keeping your mind
going,
if it's keeping your mood up, it's a good thing.
I experienced going from 75 to half of that for, say, 6 or 8 weeks, and then a quarter of that for 6 or 8 weeks, and then when I stopped taking that last quarter, within a few days, so I mean, tapering was not a possibility. So I'm still, taking it.
I understand.
It's what I'm getting at is that when people are treated for perceived depression, that I think drugs are sometimes overprescribed, or they make it so they don't realize, because this was a new drug, that how dependent you become on it, even though you'd prefer not to be. And I was surprised that I didn't think it was anything too much, and then I tried to get off it, and you can't.
Right. I understand what you're saying.
Okay,
that's a very good point, and it's true. Antidepressants should not be prescribed frivolously, of course. You're absolutely correct. I don't think in his case he did, because he saw good responses to pain with some of the antidepressants.
Mark, thank you very much for the telephone call. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your input. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-34-TALK-1. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back after the short break.
Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080. Scott Alarm Systems, licensed security and fire detection, and cell phone and web home automation, monitored by a 24/7 local central station for commercial as well as weekend and full-time residential customers. ScottAlarmSystems.com. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, celebrating 30 years of educating children and striving to inspire a lifelong love of learning. WaldorfSaratoga.org. And Gothic Inn, Block Island, Rhode Island, a Victorian bed and breakfast perched high overlooking Crescent Beach. A short walk from the town and the ferry, dogs are welcome. TheGothicInn.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Joe Donahue. We are talking about suicide, depression, and suicide prevention this afternoon. We do welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. We also welcome you to join us online, wamc.org/VoxPop, and you can get a hold of us that way as well, like John did from Rome, New York, who writes, "As has already been mentioned, to really know what goes on in this world and to feel powerless to do anything about it, how can we not be depressed to the extreme?" And that would indicate that a lot of us feel that what goes around us in life is just too much.
And certainly that can be a very, very difficult thing to come to terms with. It's really important, as much as we can, so far as we see poverty, stress, financial situations that really, really challenge us, losses of family who are dear to us and friends, to try and look at some positive things in our lives, some of our strengths. In fact, some have said that when we're depressed, we may be in crisis, and crisis is actually a wonderful place to get new opportunity, a place to re-examine where we're at, to examine our life path, and to really help us move forward and rethink where we're going. So in crisis, there is often opportunity.
And I think the last caller said that as his depression's improved, he had this aha moment. That's not an unusual kind of a response, because if you look through history at famous actors, writers, historians, Winston Churchill suffered horribly with depression, right, and yet it led to some degree of creativity. I think with regards to the world, maybe there's been an increase in our concerns because we're so inundated with information. I mean, think about it. You know, 100 years ago, you had to get the newspaper, found out bad things happened last week. Now we know, as we're sitting here, what's happening. So that can be overwhelming, and sometimes it's time to turn off the computer.
Mary wrote to us from Albany and said, Dr. Samini talked about how important it is to ask your family and friends about suicidal thoughts. This is the hardest question in the world to ask. Thinking ahead of time about what words to use can help when the need comes up. Do Dr. Samini or Dr. Tassinari have suggestions about phrases that can be useful?
We actually do lots of training at the University at Albany. We train faculty, staff, our own students, secretaries, janitors, everybody we could get access to. And what we tell them every time is that we need to be direct and we need to ask the question very clearly. Are you thinking of hurting yourself? Are you thinking of taking your life? Are you thinking of killing yourself? And if the individual says yes, there are some follow-up questions that we might want to ask. We want to listen very carefully. We also want to figure out how safe the person is. That is, if they say they may kill themselves by using a gun, we want to make sure that we know whether they have the gun or not and find a strategy to ask them to give that up. So not only do we want to ask directly, but we want to see if they have a way that they might want to hurt themselves than a plan. And so be direct. That would be my advice.
We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to get to as many phone calls as we possibly can in that short period of time. So let's go to Matt in Albany. Matt, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering what possible professional resources are available to those who may lack insurance or are too poor to afford seeking professional help on their own.
Great question.
Actually, believe it or not, there's a lot of resources in this area, and I'm sure in other areas too, where folks can get treatment for depression or any other issue, psychological issue or otherwise. And it usually starts with a call to the county mental health clinic, but certainly calling our offices too, we can help. There's many fee-for-service, like a paper, what's the term?
Sliding scale.
In fact, at SUNY even, there was a sliding scale where if you don't have a lot of money, it's really low and so on for people who have no insurance. There is certainly coverage for people with Medicaid, and there is free services available in town. And certainly you can call our office at any time and we can give you names. But luckily, we have an abundance of those, and most counties do as well in this state.
Also, I would suggest looking at some online sites like the American Psychological Association, www.apa.org, or the New York State Psychological Association. If you're looking for a psychologist, they have databases and of different places where you can get referred. And also the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-TALK, you can call them and they can help connect you with some treatment in your area.
Matt, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling.
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go over to Mary now, I believe. Is it Mary in Annandale?
Hi. I go to Bard College, and I have bipolar 2, and Robin Williams had a classic bipolar 1 disorder. And I just think he has this great quote that actually NPR shared on Twitter that says, you have to be deeply honest if you have to look for laughter. And I just think that he looked at the world in a very honest way, and I think his intense and frank personality is a direct correlation with how, you know, he dealt with his life personally and out of the public eye. And I think that we kind of have to remind ourselves that, like, it's easy to be mad at someone for committing suicide, and originally I was very mad at him myself, but I think I actually talked to my psychiatrist earlier today about it, and she said that, you know, it's you don't know what's going on, and you don't know what is going on in his private life. And I think the hardest thing for people who see the world in the way that he sees it is to remind themselves that the private life is personal for everyone. So
I think that's well stated, and I think the other thing that we have to remember with loss, whether it's by suicide or natural causes, grief is, even if it's someone we don't know, is compromised of many emotions, and included in those are guilt and anger. And we can feel guilty even though we had nothing to do with it, and we certainly can feel anger. That's part of grief. So it's not a mystery, and it's not something anyone should beat their head up about. But during grief, people do feel a certain degree of anger, even if it's someone you don't know.
Mary, thank you very much for the telephone call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Lynn now. Lynn is in Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts.
Oh, hi.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Yes, I've been listening all night long here, it seems like. And people do hide their depression when they're in therapy. But depression is actually anxiety, too, isn't it?
They frequently go together. They're not the same. No, anxiety disorders.
Not the same, no, but they go hand in hand.
They do many, many times. Absolutely, and one can lead to the other, and the other can lead to the other. Certainly, or they can coexist. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, I have a daughter that might have anxiety problems, but she's not going to. You know, she's got fears that are not reasonable, and that kind of stuff. But what's more is that anxiety does go hand in hand, and. Then there are clinics that we can't go to that are more than 10 days or less than 10 days.
There are what that you can't go to?
Clinics.
Oh. Clinics. You can't go to them for more than 10 days.
Really? That's unusual. I think most
unusual?
Of...
So in other words, is there a 10-day wait before you can get an appointment?
No.
No.
All you got to do is go to a clinic. And you all you get is 5 days, and if they don't do that, if you compress yourself in there for 10 days... That's all you get.
Are you talking about inpatient or outpatient?
A clinic, outpatient.
Oh, outpatient. That's...
Inpatient. No, inpatient.
Oh, inpatient.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like AdCare.
Yeah.
They won't take you after 10 days.
That's interesting. It depends on the severity of the illness, certainly. And most inpatient stays are meant to stabilize and to get people started and then to arrange for some kind of outpatient, whether it's intensive or not.
Right.
But it should be. Absolutely. She should get some treatment, whether it's outpatient or inpatient, because, as you said, anxiety, if it lasts a long time, it makes you depressed. I mean, everybody wakes up anxious every day. It interferes with your life and it can cause you to have some mood changes.
Lynn, thank you very much for the telephone call. Let's move over to Jay in Rosendale. Jay, go ahead.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call, Joe.
Of course.
I wanted to ask the doctors if they could talk a little bit about work-related suicide as a result of job stress and threats of job loss. I've been covering this. I'm making a film about the U.S. Postal Service called Gone Postal, and talked to many family members and psychologists and workers who've had, depressed feelings of suicide. I was just calling to see if the doctors can talk a little bit about that, especially with so much unemployment.
Work-related stress is really common. And, I think part of it is it has gone up over the years. It's been shown that years ago in the agricultural times, back 80, 100 years ago, when you left work, you left work. You didn't bring it with you. People bring their work home, and we have to fight against that because a lot of us get phone calls. We don't take a day off. We're on the computer dealing with work-related issues. We have to really fight that. The other thing is when you're feeling stressed at work, and I tell people this all the time, the first thing they have to do, and I know it's tough, but you have to go to your supervisor and say, this is really stressful. You got to help me. And most supervisors and bosses at least should be understanding, because work-related stress leads to poor productivity. So it makes sense that the boss would say, well, let's see what we can do to adjust this. But you're right. It is. Work-related stress has led to medical conditions, and now there's new studies showing that work-related stress leads to diabetes, increase in diabetes type 2, a study done in Germany recently. So we really have to get on top of this and work with employers and encourage our folks to use their EAP if they have one. The poster child has been the post office, of course, because of some horrible incidents. But talk about stress. Just on the news today, they're talking about having lost another $3 billion. So they're under pressure. But again, talking to your boss is important, and trying to not bring work home.
And for people who are working who have diagnoses of depression, they are covered by what's called the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there are civil rights that folks with diagnoses of depression. depression, anxiety, and the like have. So employers need to acknowledge that and really need to work with that.
Thank you very much for the telephone call, Jay. I think we have time for one more real quick. We'll go to Brenda in Rosendale. Brenda, go ahead.
Thank you for taking a quick time for me.
Sure.
I do want to just stress to people that the Kingston Hospital in Kingston, if you ever have a problem or a doubt or a thought or a worry, go there. And if they believe that you have if you stress to them that you feel like committing suicide, they will keep you there for as long as you need to be there. But if anyone has a question or a doubt in their own mind, the Kingston Hospital will really give you a good help. They'll keep you there as long as you need, and they'll push you to follow-up care.
Brenda,
and they'll help you with insurance or anything they need to get you to do that.
We are out of time, but thank you very much for that suggestion. I appreciate it. We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to those left on the line. Dr. Samini and Dr. Tassinari, I thank you so much for joining us today and sharing such important information. Thank you. Underwriting support comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. Pioneer Post and Beam, a non-kit post and beam builder in Belchertown, Massachusetts, designing and erecting customized barns, artist studios, garages, and additions, pioneerpostandbeam.com. And Proctor's, presenting Frank and Malachi McCourts, a couple of blackguards, September 26th through the 28th, and October 3rd through the 5th, proctors.org.